these SaaS companies, I'm like, man, I was like, hey, anybody around here, you guys know how to make some money? I've told like a lot of SaaS people like get pissed when I say, I'm like, you guys know how to make some money? You guys making money around here?
There was a Twitter post that was about this exact topic. And it was like, basically, raise your hand if you've made more annual revenue than money that you've raised. And there was like maybe five people.
Like, those are the founders that are going to have nice exits for themselves.
Welcome back to the Physician Syndicate podcast. I'm your host, Greg. And today we have another special guest, another external interview with Omar Khatib, who, if you're on LinkedIn or social media, you've probably seen some of his content. If you're one of our physician listeners,
definitely seen my content. I own that algorithm. No, but to be fair, I've been on that platform for a long time, making content, videos, and everything. So there's product managers on that platform that they ask me for insights on certain things. But
so you're doing a couple different things, right? So you have the podcast, State of MedTech, which, according to your LinkedIn, started in January of 2022. I've listened to a couple episodes to prepare for this. Love it, actually. Very highly professional compared to our content.
Thank you.
And then you've launched your own company, Khatib & Company. That was back in December 2021, so middle of pandemic.
I guess that's middle pandemic. Like, me mentally, once 2020 was over, I'm like, we're out of the pandemic. But I guess, yeah, middle of the pandemic, technically. Yeah, very long story short on that, I spent the last 10 years in med tech from sales and marketing. Back in 2015, I noticed how digital was used in e-commerce and everything else, running Facebook ads to drive adoption of product. And I was like, why can't this be done in medicine? And so people back then in my industry laughed at it. Literally laughed in my face. And it's just something I really believed in. And it's not because I'm like not Nostradamus or anything. The data was like pretty clear. It's not like I made this big prediction. And fast forward to 2020, like, I was right about a lot of those things. And 2020 was a great time to prove that out. So I proved out a lot of those strategies of the company. Went on to a software company later on. And then when I was coming back to the med tech space, so December last year, my wife was pregnant with our first child. And I remember telling her, I was like, I don't have it in me to go back to another company. Not every company is going to be like one of the best CEOs I worked for was Joe Urban, who really believed in this stuff. I was like, not every company is going to have a Joe Urban as CEO. I'm going to have to explain to the board and spend all this time convincing people. I'm like, I just want to do my own thing. And my wife, who was pregnant, was like, you should absolutely start your own company. So in December, I had no idea what kind of company I was going to start, how I was going to make money. I had a pregnant wife. But the first thought I had was like, you know what? No matter what, media is a big part of this. I'm just going to start a podcast. And I was like, what's the podcast going to be about? I'm like, medical sales stuff. But then I also love technology. I was like, we'll call it Focus on MedTech, something authoritative, State of MedTech. And then we were rolling. And then so since then, what do I do now? So Khatib & Co. essentially focuses on one mission, which is we're going to change how MedTech companies sell and market. And the way we do that is by leveraging network effects through social media to essentially do three things: attracting investors at scale, growing sales pipeline, and then driving product adoption. And a second part of that, or a part of that, is my work with physicians. So that's why I was very excited to come on this show. In a previous life, I was in medical school in Texas. I left halfway through to join the med tech industry. My father's a surgeon. So for me, I have a deep admiration and love for physicians. It kills me to see a physician who's miserable in their job. And so if there's any way that I can help a physician kind of spark a fire in them to get engaged with industry, to get paid by industry, to advise startups, and just have a breath of fresh air from the drudgery of medicine, which, by the way, I don't think a single physician out there dislikes the practice of medicine. Every physician I know loves medicine. They love treating patients. They love doing surgery. My father, he would come home from work. He's retired now. He's, I can't believe I get paid to do this. Nobody dislikes that. What physicians dislike is the administrative burden that they have to deal with, which is becoming more and more what medicine's about, unfortunately. So that's, in a nutshell, who I am and what I believe.
Yeah, that actually brings up an interesting point. We had a podcast recording with Daniel Wren, who has his own kind of physician finance podcast, and we were talking about direct care. and how he's seen such a difference in the people that are employed going from academic hospital A to I'm going to go start my own practice and it's just going to be a direct to consumer practice, cash based. I've seen such a change in the attitude and the burnout rates of those physicians because it goes back to I'm not doing my notes to be billed through Epic. It's now I actually got to take care of patients. I got to think through, you know, what do I actually need to do for this patient because they're paying me in cash, which means that's nice for the physician. They don't have to go through insurance and billing and all that kind of stuff. So it does bring up an interesting thing of the practice of medicine, how it's changed so much. It's an interesting thing, right? Like you were in medical school. You left to go to a company within kind of the med tech or was it a software company or was it actually
a robotics company? World's first robotic spine platform, Mazor Robotics.
Yeah. So how did you end up making that decision? What did people did you think?
It was a very long, painful decision. So essentially, since I was a kid, it was a dream for me to become a doctor. I really looked up to admire my father. I was like, I'm going to be a surgeon. And in college, I went to a regular state university, University of Texas, El Paso, worked three jobs through college, did all the pre-med requirements. I did research. I did all these things. There was one problem, which was my MCAT scores weren't that great. So I did research, killed myself to get into medical school. And I did so well in my interviews and at least outside of my MCAT score, my GPA, everything just looked great. So I got into medical school. Not only I got on pre-admission. So Texas is one of the states where you can get early accepted. So I got early accepted. A month later, I find out I got full scholarship. It's like a dream come true. It's like the ultimate Paramount picture presents like underdog story of some guy goes to some state university, grinds his way, not only gets into medical school, full scholarship, hometown. I remember I took a picture with the papers because I was part of an inaugural class. And a year in, I just started feeling, I don't know if this is for me. And you don't know it until you're in the system, right? And once I was a year in, I did okay. And then I decided to take some time off. I did a little bit of research, but I had to repeat my first year. So I did that. So repeated my first year. I was like, you know what? The way I looked at it was like, you know what? That'll help me get a really good board score. That's how I justified it. I didn't fight it because they're like, if you're going to take a little time off, like you're going to probably have to repeat the first year. And I was like, yeah, you know what? That's fine. So repeated the first year, got through it. Second year, things aren't getting better. It's just like feeling really depressed. And two things happened. Like one is that I heard about this guy who is an anesthesiology resident at UCSF. Like what a dream residency to be at. And the guy was like essentially feeling the same way that I did in MS1 and MS2, but he just didn't do anything about it. And he's like, maybe it'll get better. Maybe it'll get better. And then he got to a point where, you know, and this is like the story was told to a friend of mine. They were like, yeah, he got into residency. And when we last caught up with him, he's like, yeah, like I'm in too deep. I can't quit now. That scared me. That really scared me is if I took this so far that like nothing gets better. And so I remember I sat down, had a conversation with my father and told him how I was feeling and everything. And he said, it's not going to get any easier. And if you decide to leave, like you have my full support. And mind you, I'm first generation American. My dad is a general surgeon from Iraq. And I'm the eldest. I'm the firstborn. I'm a son. And he was very supportive of it. So I ended up leaving. That was really tough. I felt like a huge weight was lifted off my shoulders. Very much like a lot of physicians listening to this. I'm sure those who decide to leave academia, it's so taboo. But a huge weight is lifted off your shoulder. And I applied to jobs. All these med tech companies, and I still criticize them to this day. All these med tech companies, they preach, oh, we want clinical excellence. But when somebody who has clinical background applies, they're like, oh, we don't have sales experience. And so I went through that with a lot of companies. One company decided to take a bet on me, which is this little Israeli company, world's first robotic spine company. Why did they do that? Because they had two ex-medical students just like me who were just doing amazing for the company. And they decided, they're like, hey, let's hire another one of these guys. And you know, as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things to unpack there. So I think for most physicians, when they go through med school, they're not lucky enough to have a full scholarship unless you're going to NYU, or now it's basically free to go through, and a couple other schools. I think Mayo is one of those. Thinking through like the feeling of being trapped, right? If you're like 80,000, 150,000 in debt at that point, and you're like half.
Oh, yeah. Sunk loss fallacy is a real thing, man. Yeah.
So that's at least a positive for you having a full scholarship. It's you're a year or two in and it's not right for me. It's like, at least you didn't have the student loans that were just.
Oh, man. Down. If I had 30, 40, 50K in debt. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. And also going back to the sales point, I was never a salesperson, but for my company that we built, I don't know if you know my background. So my wife and I built a company, FlipMD, which we ultimately sold to GoodRx after 18 months of operating it. Literally, like, you as a physician, this is always one of the things that I preach on this podcast, is if you have an idea as a physician, you can learn the startup world. You can learn the business side of things. You can learn how to sell, because as a founder, that's what you're going to have to do. But yeah, not taking a bet on a person that's gone through a couple years of med school is crazy. I'm sure that
there's happens all the time
now.
Like, it happens all the time.
Had that guy, he was in our pipeline to potentially interview and say, yeah, but he didn't. Now the world's a different place. So I think, yeah, having those clinical skills, or at least the clinical background, the clinical knowledge, is a huge value add to a lot of different companies, which is also why we started that company. So one of the reasons that I reached out to you was because of one of your LinkedIn posts, which had to do with kind of venture capital and why they're not investing more into kind of hardware companies, medical device companies, and things like that. With today's world of going from Web3 being the most popular where to throw dollars at, to now we're directly into AI, now that ChatGPT came out and all these companies are building on top of it, I think you are seeing one of those changes in the health tech, digital health, whatever you want to call it, is a lot of people are looking for the next AI company within the healthcare space, which we've talked about on this podcast quite a bit. One of my concerns for those digital health companies that are going out there to compete against a Microsoft or a Google, whoever it is, you're competing against incumbents that are now moving super fast with ChatGPT, Nuance introducing ambient technology that a lot of companies have been doing for the last few years. What have you seen in terms of the companies you're working with? How hard is it for them to go out and raise capital, specifically like med device companies?
Yeah.
With AI coming up, and it's like, where did the dollars flow to?
It's super hard. It's super hard. In the last 5 years, in terms of like returns and revenue, like hardware companies were responsible for something like 60% of it, but yet they received, I don't know, less than 10% of the investment dollars out there. It's just really hard. And the reason why is that, and again, this is similar to my observation back in 2015 about physicians will use social media like everybody else, and everybody else, like, that's how they're going to be, their behavior is going to be molded by it. On the same token, you know, social media and the singularity that we're in is like causing people to have, it's not shorter attention spans, but just harder to get attention these days. And in order, you have to get attention and hold attention in order to persuade. And when you have these unicorn companies that from the software industry, where they are very low capital to operate, they have 50x, 100x return that can happen within a period of 5 years, really hard to get an investor to cough up money and say, hey, you want to bankroll this like hardware company that's going to take like a 10, 15 year grind? So it's really tough these days. And that's why you'll see a lot of med tech companies, which I think is a very viable route, but you really got to know what you're doing, is go through the equity crowdfunding route. So like Monogram Orthopedics, the big success story, it's a robotic orthopedic company. They've raised 20 or 23 million through equity crowdfunding, right? And so I think that now it's really tough to raise capital these days, but there's more vehicles to do it, including one area that I'm a big fan of is like a lot of these family offices or private investors who have a lot of money and they want to invest in a social good. And they really believe in something. And so they're going to put money into companies that are going to have a really big impact on health and just say, hey, like whatever it's going to take, let's do this. But to be empathetic on the side of the VCs, because I do know a lot of VCs that come on my show, they are beholden to LPs, right? And so they can't just do things for the sake of social good all the time.
And also for the VC angle, it's like you have your fund window, how long you have to deploy it, what you're looking for in terms of like returns and how quickly that comes through. You can expect a software company to exit anywhere from 6 to 10 years in the future, whether that's an acquisition or an IPO, a hardware company or a device company that has to go through the regulatory hurdles of an FDA before you start selling your product. It just becomes this kind of like time hurdle that you have to jump through in order to get that funding. The outcomes, though, on the other side are gigantic still for these hardware companies and for the device companies that ultimately sell maybe to a Johnson & Johnson or a Stryker or whoever it is. Like, those numbers are outrageous, and they can be very large exits. It's just the timing of those exits is difficult. And if you don't have a venture capital firm that has a physician or two that understands the market of some of these new technologies and new products that are coming out, it might be difficult to sell them on it. So I do like the idea of the crowdfunding aspect of it. I think one of the other interesting ways that you can start to think about how do you fund some of these companies that seem unfundable to a venture capitalist is go figure out how to create an SPV around physicians that would like to back that company. So if it's a new interventional cardiology device, go get some ICs out there to potentially throw in $25,000, $50,000 checks. That can also then help you distribute that product potentially. And I think that's one of the interesting things about startups, especially going into the healthcare space, is I feel like the hardest part for any company trying to sell to a hospital or to a physician is going to be distribution.
Yeah.
How do you get in front of those decision makers? How do you get your product, show what the ROI is going to be for those physicians, providers, whoever you're selling it to? And I think that's what you help with a little bit in terms of like social media and things like that, is like using platforms. And you're right, like physicians now on LinkedIn and Twitter, case posts, like you see people going through, this is what we did for this new interventional radiology procedure, and showing like actual imaging and how that actually works. It's pretty cool actually to also be able to, for those physicians, connect with patients that might be out there or venture capitalists like you're talking about. So it's an extremely interesting time to be alive with social media and how it's working now.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of the companies that you've seen or you were aware of, let's go with mostly early stage at this point. So Series B and below, what are you most interested in right now? Actually, are you investing at all? Do you invest on the side, or is it mostly you're just working with companies through your company?
Yeah, I do invest on the side, not as much as I used to. There's a syndicate I'm a part of, but right now, like, any extra cash I got is either going to my kids' college fund, or more so on the business side as well. But yeah, I do invest on the side. In terms of things that get me interested, my thing with hardware is that you need hardware to essentially automate certain processes. Right. So you have good hardware that automates a process. You're able to capture data through that. And then if you capture data through an automated process, you own that process, and then you can create new standards and guidelines. So a perfect example of this is like the company I used to work for, Potrero Medical. Potrero Medical has a critical care monitoring system that automates urine output. Urine output is a very important indicator for acute kidney injury. And as Potrero has automated this process, this physiological process that was never automated before and captures continuous data, which never was captured before, they own the kidney. And again, I haven't worked for them in, gosh, like 2 or 3 years now. So I don't know what they're up to. I follow them a lot on LinkedIn. They're driving a lot of product adoption. They've digitized the kidney. And I feel like at any moment, like, they are probably a really good strategic target for a company because they've automated a process. And they own the data for an organ, right? That's really valuable. So companies that are doing things like that, those ones really excite me. There's one company that just I spoke to recently. They are, I believe, in the middle of raising a Series B called Omniscient Neurotech. Omniscient's a great example of this, is that there's no way that they could have raised money through traditional venture capital. They actually had to go to private investors who really believed in the mission. Omniscient Neurotech essentially is a connectomics software company, meaning that they essentially mapped the human brain to figure out the circuitry of the human brain, how do different regions of the brain communicate to each other. So that way, when you go to, let's say, psychiatry, it was really founded by neurosurgeons, so their applications are in neurosurgery. But on the psychiatric part, which is really exciting, you go get an MRI scan, you go to a psychiatrist, they read it, and they're like, oh, you know what? There's an issue between the circuitry between this region of the brain, that region of the brain. we're going to treat that with transcranial magnetic stimulation, medication, et cetera. So now it's not the subjective thing of, oh, I think you're depressed. There's four or five different levels of depression. Which one is it? Is it like, is your depression secondary to something else? You know, things like that provide new data, new information to a clinician. Those are the kind of things that get me excited. Similar to Potrero, right? Once you have new data and insights into a disease state, right? That'll influence how it's going to be treated and the therapeutics that follow it. That's one side. The other side, Sophie Nova Partners, which is Europe's largest venture capital firm. Interesting fact, when venture capital started 4 decades ago or something, there are three firms, Sequoia, Kleiner Perkins, Sophie Nova. So anyway, Sophie Nova just launched a digital medicine arm where they really focus a lot on things that are like digital therapeutics, platforms that influence the workflow of medicine. So I feel like that's pretty exciting. Those are the things that kind of caught my eye. I still have a soft spot for robotics. I love robots. But most robots that I've seen today, I don't want to say, yeah, not all. Most of them are just incremental improvements on existing technology and not something really transformative.
Interesting. So yeah, going back to Omniscient, that's an interesting one because that feels like that's like a category defining type of company that if you're right. able to map or how different neurons interact and how different regions of the brain interact and then can build on top of that, sounds like a platform play for other companies similar to something we've talked about a lot now is like ChatGPT, right? Taking imaging and structures of the brain and saying, okay, now we know how certain disease states interact. And now can we actually build on top of that using another platform to actually target medicines or, like you said, even digital therapeutics, right? And then having an actual outcome that you can measure that is actually physiological rather than just a survey or something else. That
exactly. Exactly.
Or something. So that's pretty interesting.
I would say like for me, it's not always focused on technology. I get excited by any company that looks like they are truly designing a new category. And what I mean by that is most companies are just playing in existing categories and trying to show how they're just better. And that's not a $1 billion company in my mind. A $1 billion company is something that's going to go and say, hey, here's the current market. We're going over here, doing something completely new and different because that's going to attract true believers, true innovators and early adopters. And you know, there's a lot of risk in those kind of companies, but there's also a lot of return. Those are the kind of companies I get excited about.
Yeah, that's a lot of what we talk about, especially when we're talking about angel investing, is like when you're looking to angel invest, you're not looking for a 5, a 10X. You're looking for those companies that are going to create completely different categories that are going to change the funding for future companies that are going to try to basically innovate on whatever that company is actually doing. So the more that you can find companies that are trying to create their own categories within medicine or within whatever field they're going into, and that's also the fun one where you're like, your TAM is this right now. But if you actually do build what you're saying you're going to build, it'll go on and scale to something else. So one of the companies that I just invested in that went through YC was a company called Pando Biosciences. And basically what they're trying to do is use, you know, machine learning and AI and figure out what new novel drug targets are out there. So most drugs, they go after single proteins, cancer drugs, P53, whatever it is. What they're trying to do is basically say, it doesn't seem like it's actually the proteins themselves, but it's likely the interaction between multiple proteins that is causing the disease state. So what they're trying to do is basically map all of these different protein interactions and then go and actually build novel drug targets that'll stop those interactions rather than the individual kind of proteins themselves, which is super interesting. And the other thing that I remember asking the founder, Will, I was like, okay, this sounds like a cool platform play for like a Pfizer or whoever is going to try to like actually build on top of this information. But it's, if you're discovering these novel drug targets, like what are you going to do with that? And she's, we're going to go out and manufacture medications too. I was like, that's the interesting piece, right? You're no longer a platform play, but now you're basically going to go out and actually compete against the Pfizers and the Gileads and all these other companies that are also probably going to be using your technology. But it's like you cherry pick those winners. You go build and you compete against the pharma companies out there. So that's one that I'm like, I can see how your TAM is a certain size now as a platform play, but you're going to grow that to a completely different level potentially. So that's one I'm excited about. That's very early stage. That was a pre-seed investment, but they also built out the research themselves.
That's very impressive.
So, pretty cool. Yeah, there's some pretty cool companies out there. Speaking about other companies, in terms of like, where you think there's not enough being built right now? Like, what are some open lanes for people to go out and build in, knowing that you have a lot of physicians in this audience
anything that you can think of where you're like, if a physician can come in and build with this problem in mind, I see that as being a very large company.
Oh, yeah. I don't know about a large company, but my thing is, as a physician, you should look at things that have been just accepted as like normal and ask yourself, what if we lived in a world where this is not normal? Like, for example, Alzheimer's, right? It affects like, I don't know, what, 40 or 50 million people, something insane like that. Is that normal? No. So like Alzheimer's, I think a lot of things in the brain space are important. Depression, mental health is another area. I'm trying to think. For me, I have a bias towards surgery. I love surgical devices. It's not enough. If you're looking at something, if you can't figure out like what the TAM is, okay, so like acute kidney injury, like it kills like 300,000 people every year in the United States. That's not normal, right? But the other side of it is, if you look at a procedure that's 10 steps and you're like, if some magical wand existed, we can do this in 5, you have something, right? And again, like the one thing I would tell physicians is that I'm going to say something because I love physicians. Like I don't have an MD, I got half an MD, but I consider myself part of the tribe because of my training and because of the fact that I have a father who's a physician. But the culture of medicine has been very much focused on just doing the work, which there's something to be said about it. That being said, the reason why healthcare is the way it is today is because physicians abandoned the responsibility of managing the business side of medicine because they just didn't want to do it. They just want to treat patients. And that worked through the 70s and 80s, somewhat 90s. But we're living in a time where just working hard is not enough. And this is why you have lobbyists. And that's why you have, I don't know, a 100-fold increase in hospital admins compared to physicians over the last 10 years. It's because you've abandoned the responsibility of understanding the business side. And so when it comes to developing a new technology, you can't just look at the part that you're comfortable with, which is the clinical side, right? Because you can come up with all kinds of really cool devices that would be cool to have. It's not enough to just be cool, right? You have to look at the business side and be like, does this actually make an impact on the cost of the procedure? Can this make an impact on the timing, right? Patient care. The obvious things, is this clinically helpful? Is it going to impact patient care? Those boxes are always going to be checked by a physician because that's your comfort zone. You have to go out of comfort zone and be like, can we make money with this? And one thing, I actually did an episode on my podcast a few days ago, which is to use CMS open payments data. So the CMS has open payments. It's free. You can literally look up any physician, any hospital, any company and see what were they paid per year. One of the things I recommend to founders is you don't want to give equity up early, right? You can look and see who is the top paid person or physician for Medtronic. There's a couple of physicians that were paid last year, like $19, $20, $30 million, right? Mainly through royalties and licenses. Those are the kind of people you should talk to because they understand like what does it take to develop a new device and think about it and say, what would make this an appealing acquisition target for a company? So spending time learning those things is where I really advise physicians on doing, plus the marketing side, right? Whether you're a digital opinion leader or you're a physician trying to raise money, like you got to learn how to tell a story and market it well through social media. Right? It sounds like a simple thing to do, but it's not easy.
So going back to the idea of the physicians having a great idea for a medical device, right? That's like step 0.5, right? It's like everybody can have a really good idea. The problem is like, if you don't do anything with that idea, if you don't execute, and have that idea actually grow.
Exactly. Your company. I just need to just drop a quick comment. I'm not a lawyer. Okay. This is not legal advice. But I'm a guy who's been in the game for a little over 10 years. I live and breathe this stuff. Please, for the love of God, if you come up with an idea, do not go spend $100,000 talking to a patent attorney. We don't live in the day anymore where you can come up with a patent on something that has no commercial viability. Yeah. And then Medtronic are just like, yeah, sure, we'll buy your patent for $1 million. We don't live in those. And if you know somebody who that happened to, you're like, Omar, I know that is literally a drop in the bucket. I would not bet on that. So please save your money.
Like, if you have that really good whatever procedure that you're trying to innovate on, but then just publish it in an academic paper And then it's cool. Now, like, any company can go and just say, that's a really cool idea. Let me go build that myself, monetize the crap out of it. You'll get nothing for it. So that's the other thing is I have friends, right, within the IR world, two of them specifically at my old program that have a tremendous number of really interesting device ideas. And they came to me. I was like, do not publish. Do not tell anybody what your idea is. If you guys ultimately want to build that, start working on it now. Figure out how do you actually go through the FDA steps? How do you go from animal testing to in-person testing, blah, blah, blah. And it's do not actually publish anything around that. I would never do that.
Yeah, I agree.
They actually took the steps of going, hey, what does the market look like? They started looking through research papers and stuff like that. That's the ultimate, that's the right thing to do. And I guess my question to you is, have you seen any good incubators, accelerators for something like this? Because, like, I've seen there's YC, that's the most famous one, but it's like if you're a med device company,
you don't want to go to really YC. No, YC. Yeah,
like, I know a company that went through there, they're like, whatever, but like, I know what UT Houston has something,
UT Houston has
agreement, but yeah, any really good ones, you're like, that is something that you should definitely apply to.
I should have a better answer for this, but the one that I really love is an incubator called Theranova out of San Francisco. That's the one that Potrero Medical came out of. The founder is a physician, Dan Burnett. He's literally like a brilliant guy, a mad scientist in the sense that like every device that's gone through there, he is personally tested on himself. And yes, that includes Potrero Medical, which involves a smart Foley catheter and a critical care monitoring device. Like, this guy's committed. So that's a
dedication.
That's a great example. But by the way, another, while we're talking, and for your physicians who are listening, please connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm actually going to have a miniature course coming out soon for physicians just on how to develop yourself as a digital opinion leader through your LinkedIn profile, right? So you can raise money, attract companies, et cetera. So Greg, on one side, yeah, don't go publish it and everything. On the other side of it, you have to understand most companies do not care and they do not have the time. This is why big companies acquire things. They don't innovate internally. And I'm going to piss off everybody at Medtronic and Jay. They don't. Like, they just, it's just too much bureaucracy. And so the likelihood that someone's going to hear your idea and then go and act on it, it's very unlikely. And last thing, because this is like a, because again, there's ways of operating within medicine. Like when you go into a surgical room, right? There's certain times you speak, there's certain places you stand, like, but no, there's nobody who teaches you. You just have to learn from like the grapevine. So this is one of those moments I want to share. If you have an idea and you're looking to get advice, let's say you come to me, right? Or you go to Greg or somebody else and you just want to talk about it. For the first conversation, don't ask anybody to sign an NDA. That is a great way for me to say, signing your NDA. No. Don't care.
No investor is going to sign an NDA.
Yeah, no.
Your idea is meaningless until you actually execute.
That's a big thing. Even on the execution side, like I know companies that are commercial and they're like, we want to talk to you about XYZ, whatever. Can you sign an NDA? I'm like, no. I'm like, let's talk. Talk in generalities with me. And then if you're going to show me things that are really personal and private to the company, like sure, I'll sign an NDA at that point. But first, it's like a rookie move, man. Just like first call, first meeting, first conversation, do not ask for the NDA. There's some people who have this thought like, oh, I'm going to be taken more seriously if I show up with an NDA. No, it's just like amateur hour. And I would say like in Silicon Valley, there is a level of reputation that's holding up, which is, hey, we don't sign NDAs because if I hear your ideas and I screw you over, like my reputation is going to float around people and people will know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely, if you want to come off as somebody that's never tried to raise money and you send that email and say, here's my NDA. Nobody's gonna sign an NDA. I honestly cannot think of one example where, yeah, sure, I'll sign an NDA to see what you're building. Especially early stage.
Like, yeah, no early way. Stage is just no. No early stage at that point, like you're literally, and again, this is another shortcoming of physicians is that having a lot of ego. So let's take your average surgeon who's used to everybody and their mother sucking up to them. And now they're going to start a company. So now they're like, oh, I'll just have this ego about it. Hey, I want to set a meeting with you. No, it's just not. So when you're early stage, you should just be like hat in hand, like really kind, really like open to listening. And then, and people go out of their way to hurt. Yeah. People go out of their way to help.
Come into the space, go learn it. Go listen to podcasts, go watch YouTube videos, figure out what the hell does venture capital actually do.
Go talk to ChatGPT. ChatGPT will give you like some steps. Yeah. Anything.
That was the thing that we did when we started a company. It was like, I have no idea what this world is about, but I do know one thing. I know how to learn. I can go learn something, right? I'll go find the resources and I'll take my time while I'm putting my two kids down. One of them just sleeping on my arm. I'll listen to a podcast or two. That's what you have to do, is like actually put in the work, actually grind a little. Like, nobody's just going to hand you $3 million because you have an idea.
Exactly. Exactly. And on the same token, like, that's the one thing I would say is, like, a lot of physicians feel like hopeless, right? Because they're like, especially going into doing a new thing, they just feel very hopeless. But what I'd say is, like, the one thing you learn as a physician is how to be a learning machine. That was like the one superpower I left medical school with. I was like, I can teach myself anything. You have a massive advantage with that. So
there's that piece. And then also just the ability to put your head down and just grind, right?
Dude, I remember
my surgical intern.
It's a superpower.
Going through trauma and having Q3 call, where you take 24-hour call, you stay in the hospital. It's not 24-hour call. It's more like a 30, 31, 32-hour call. That's when you learn that you can do literally anything. And it's, I can go learn anything. I can put my head down and work and do anything. Like, you as a physician know how to work. You know how to grind. There is no 8 to 5 for you. Like, more than likely, if you're a surgeon, if you're a proceduralist, you're waking up at 5 o'clock, 4:30 to do your workout before you go to the hospital. Like, you know how to put in the work. And it's, if you transfer that over to entrepreneurial activities, it becomes a superpower for you. Like, you can go compete with those companies that maybe aren't putting in as much work as you are. So keep that in mind too. Again, like, I love backing physician founders. I've backed, I think, 2 now in angel investments, and you guys can do some, you can do a fair amount of work and you can figure out this world.
Absolutely.
It doesn't take that long to learn.
And on the flip side, I love physician founders. I'm also very careful with them, because the other issue is that as a physician, you really start to believe that you can do everything you cannot. The physician, so perfect example, I actually just had him on my show, Dr. Shugru, who's the founder of Omniscient. When I talked to him, and he's a neurosurgeon, but the guy shoots straight from the, I really enjoyed talking to him. He's, in my opinion, a great physician founder. Because I asked him, I was like, when I was at Blaine's and I went by their booth, we're talking. I was like, so are you the CEO of the company? He's like, oh, hell no. He's like, I'm not that stupid. I went and hired a CEO. I don't know how to do that. I have tremendous amount of respect for that. The best surgeons that I worked with when I was a rep, I'll never forget, there's a guy, Dr. Crutchfield out of Tyler, Texas. But anyway, neurosurgeon, brilliant guy, like really well respected. We're doing a robotic case. First time I'm working with him, we finished the robotic side and we finished the procedure. And as he's closing up, he looks up and he's like, hey, Omar, can you give me and the team some feedback? How do we do today? What can we improve on? And the guy's done more robotic procedures than I was in at that moment. The fact that he was so humble about it, it was just like, hey, give me some feedback. That's how you have to be as a physician. There's a time and a place, I think, where you got to lead hard with your ego and be like, you know what, I can do this, etc. But then you get to a point where you're like, you got to hire people. Look, I'm a marketer, okay? I'm really damn good at it. Guess who's running my ads? Not me. Because it just, if you think about it, it's, hey, I'm really good at marketing. I know how to run ads. I'm very good at copy, right? All these things. But who's going to do a better job at this point running ads, let's say on LinkedIn? Me, where I see an ad set 5-10 times a week, or the agency that I use, who sees like thousands of them every week from different companies, different industry and everything. I'm like, it's just like an objective. There's nothing about this that I have to have an ego about.
Yeah, to put that into medical terms, right? Do you want to go take care of your pancreatic cancer and get a Whipple from community surgeon that maybe does 1 a year? Or do you want to go to an academic hospital that does 5 a week, 10 a week? Like, you have to think about it that way too. I think you're right. But on the flip side of that too is, go learn everything. You don't just
absolutely
say, hey, I'm going to be completely hands off. I don't need to learn how to run a LinkedIn ad. Go learn it.
Oh, 100%.
You can spot the people that know what the hell they're talking
about. That is exactly correct.
You're like, oh yeah, that sounds great. And then you work with them for 6 months and you're like, you got me absolutely nothing.
Yeah,
you're like, oh, that's why you guys actually didn't know what the hell you're talking
about. That's exactly right. And this is why I feel like physicians are going to make things better, because of this idea of continuing medical education. And this is like one of the great mysteries of the world right now for me, which is the med tech industry. When you sell into a customer base, you become that customer. So if you look at the average med tech executive, salesperson, market, they've become like a physician. right? They're skeptical about things. They're conservative. There's all these things they've adopted. The one thing they have not adopted is this concept of continuing education. I have no idea why, but yeah, this is the one thing that's, it is a superpower for physicians, which is like constantly learning. And so find out, it's what I did with marketing, which is when I started marketing, I found the top 10 most read marketing books. I started with those, read some other things, listened to some podcasts. That kind of led me into like more psychology and persuasion. Those things started to fuse. And then it becomes a lot more interesting. And you become you're able to have a deeper discussion with people about certain approaches. And then you're able to take those discussions for, it's just, you know what? It's just like ChatGPT, man. If you don't know how to engineer a good prompt, like you're only going to get so good of an answer.
Crappy results.
Yeah. By the way, I really believe like ChatGPT is an idiot savant. It really is. Because like I was using it yesterday. Again, I use it on a daily basis for all kinds of things. Some days I'm just like, oh my God, this thing is unbelievable. I'll say to my computer, I'm like, ChatGPT, you're the MVP today. And there's other days like yesterday where I asked it to write some copy for me. I looked at it, I'm like, this is garbage. I'm like, what is this? I'm like, come on, ChatGPT. It's funny because
you now have people like putting out job posts for prompt engineers, which it makes sense. I remember
I
was playing around with it when it first started hitting like the mainstream.
When it was like 3.0 and stuff.
November or something. Yeah. And like I was playing around with it so much, like I learned how to actually prompt it. And oh, you can actually tell it to be more concise or be punchier, like whatever you want it to do with it. You can put in additional prompts even after. And like my wife was like, oh, I don't know how to do the things that I want it to do. I'm like, you got to play around with it more.
Yeah, you have to have a conversation with it. I'll tell you a really interesting thing to do, which is one of my favorite things. I'll tell it to be an author. Of like, for example, I told it, like one of the things where I was like, ChatGPT, you're the MVP today. I told it, so Robert Greene, who wrote the 48 Laws of Power, 33 Strategies of War, just amazing author. So I told him, I said, ChatGPT, pretend to be an apprentice who studied under Robert Greene. I want you to take the 48 Laws of Power, and then I want you to pretend that you've interviewed Al Reeves, who wrote the 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing. I want you to come up with a framework for the laws of marketing power. And it came up with these 7 laws of marketing power. And I was like, damn, that's good. And I read, this is my field. And I was reading, I was like, that's really good. So that was one. The other one I had to do was Everett Rogers, who wrote Diffusion of Innovations back in the 50s. I told it to be Everett Rogers. And I said, explain the diffusion of innovation as it applies to medical sales using social media and use physics to explain it. And it, when it wrote, it was like, wow, I was chef's kiss all the way.
It's one of the most powerful tools. I think it is the most powerful tool I've seen come out easily in my lifetime.
Do you see what Sam Altman had a great response when they decided to start monetizing it? They asked, they're like, how are you going to make money? And he's, I don't know. He's, I'm going to ask ChatGPT to come up with monetization.
I saw that. He's no, I'm really not kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
it's a very powerful thing.
Yeah. And I think... Here's my other, I'm going to make a radical prediction. ChatGPT is not going to eliminate a single job. Not a single one.
I think it's just going to make people more efficient.
I think it's going to make people more efficient.
It's going to make your life easier.
Yeah.
You're going to be able to do more.
Look, it's like computers did not eliminate a single librarian job. Like when computers coming out, every librarian, like this is going to get rid of our jobs and everything. It actually made more librarian jobs because you needed more people to manage these things. And I think perfect example. Look, I'm a marketer. I think one time I hired a copywriter, somebody who just all they did was copywriting, right? So people who are like, oh, copywriter jobs. I'm like, okay, it's not like everybody wakes up, I want to be a copywriter for a full-time job. But graphic design is definitely one of those things, right? So people are like, oh, now with generative AI, graphic designers are going to be, absolutely not. You think I'm getting on the generative AI design platform and spending time trying to come, no. There's a graphic designer who's doing that now. So it's just made their job a lot easier and better. And I think especially somebody who's really interesting to follow is Kevin Kelly. Kevin Kelly was the founder of Wired Magazine, and he's probably the most interesting man in the world. Like, I don't say that's not hyperbolic, like literally the most interesting man in the world. But he does art with AI every day. And so he's been posting on Twitter where he's just like spending a lot of time like going back and forth with AI and developing artwork. He's somebody definitely worth following.
It's always interesting too, like all of these conversations that I've had with like external people between Ronak and I, who's the other host, it's like a lot of the times it comes back to AI right now. Like it feels like such a big shift
in everything. And we ended up doing a podcast episode that was just a reaction. I don't know if you saw this article that came out in JAMA Internal Medicine that was comparing ChatGPT responses to like physician responses. Did you see that article?
Oh yeah, yeah, I did. I did. Yeah, yeah. Whereas like,
it's like I'm
like it was more empathetic
on ChatGPT.
The one that was, yeah, was whereas more like empathetic. More empathetic. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's exactly. Interesting because I think it's a crap article, to be honest. If you actually read the article, it's oh yeah, we used Reddit, an anonymous forum for these like responses. It's like you're not going to get an actual accurate response to like how a physician is actually going to talk in a professional environment.
Yeah.
But I'm still extremely bullish that freaking ChatGPT is going to make physicians' lives easier. The question is,
oh, totally.
Just throw more things on top of it, probably.
Think of it like this. In medical school, so one of the things I really excelled at, and I think this is an indicator that I was supposed to go into sales, is that patient encounters. Nothing got me more excited than when I was about to open the door and see what's behind it to talk to a patient. I love it. This is like cold calling. But most people don't know how to do that. And they don't teach this in medical school and residency. Like, they don't teach certain things when you walk in. These are the things you should say. This is how you should look at everything. But you can script ChatGPT. Like, here's an interesting prompt for physicians to do is, if you're a physician, you have an idea. Let's say you have a business plan or whatever. By the way, I can't believe I said that. Business plans, like, nobody does that anymore. But you can take that document, upload it to ChatGPT, tell ChatGPT, pretend to be a venture partner at Sequoia. Ask me questions about my business. So again, like, I think the more, yeah, just practice. That's exactly right. And I think with physicians, here's what I'd say. And I take a lot of credit for one of two things, getting people to quit medical school and then getting people to like leave clinical medicine. So I successfully got a friend of mine who is a nephrologist. His name's Kasim Budd, brilliant guy. And he's still practicing, but he left his practice. He does, I think, locums now, but he's mainly in med tech. What I'd say is that a lot of times, let's say I'm going to speak directly to that physician who's in academia, who's miserable with their job, and they want to, it's always thought of this big jump. I'm going to quit. I'm going to do this. And then when you think about that, it scares the hell out of you and you don't end up doing. What I would say is just take a tiny step. Just put your foot in the water by getting on LinkedIn. If you're listening to this podcast, that's a great start, right? Get on LinkedIn, start digesting some content. Maybe look and see there's a conference to go to, maybe a meetup. Just go and interact with people. The best conference for emerging med tech investments is called LSI, Life Science Intelligence. I love that organization. I don't even go to JP Morgan anymore. LSI. So every year they have two conferences, one in Europe, one in the US. The tickets, I think, cost anywhere from $3,000 to $4,000. Believe me when I say it's worth every single penny. I had to twist some arms of physicians to tell them to go because it's like the ticket was like $3,000 or $4,000 plus it's at the Waldorf Astoria. So it's at a luxury resort, but it is the most magical week. Like for me, that's like Coachella for me. Like I get depressed when that thing ends, but spend the money, write it off and go to one of these summits just to, and being in person at these events, just to feel it, right? I would say is really important thing. You don't get the same feeling when you go to like your academic medical conference and you go to the exhibit hall. You need to go to an investing startup event, see the pitches, talk to founders, like just get that energy and then use that energy the following week or two to take it further, right? That's how these things start. And then little by little, one year later, you're quitting your job and venturing off into the startup world.
Yeah, raising a bunch of venture capital or going to join an early stage startup. That's, for a lot of physicians out there, that is like a very interesting angle to potentially take, is jumping from full-time clinical work to potentially helping a lot more patients if you go join a startup or go start your own company. Again, that's a lot of the reason that I started this podcast was I want to see more physician entrepreneurs get out there, raise capital, do the things that they think.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know what? Like, here's the other thing. And we forget about these things as pre-meds, as physicians, as medical students, which is what we did to get into the world we're in. We forget that those things work in other places. So when you're a pre-med, what did you do? You would go and bend over backwards to work at a pathology lab or whatever. So, hey, I'll clean. I remember I told a pathologist, I was like, I'll clean the glassware. Just let me work in the lab for free. Use LinkedIn. And again, follow me because I'm going to have a little mini course on this. You can get a lot from my current course as well, but it's mainly for medical, so it's still the same thing. But use LinkedIn to engage with founders and salespeople at certain startups and reach out to them and offer to help for free, right? Even if it's just,
or if you, you know, find their product super interesting and you think it's a great idea, consider investing.
Yeah, I was gonna say you can do that.
Use that side of things too.
Yeah, you can do that. If you can think of, if you're any, if anything you use, talk to the rep and say, hey, I actually want to get a little bit more involved on maybe a little product management side, maybe becoming a, an opinion leader for you guys. Can I talk to like your head of marketing or anything? I just want to get more engaged. You just have to learn. And again, this is another skill set that nobody teaches, except I'm going to. Yes. I'm going to. So yeah, how to, as a physician, how do you become a really good opinion leader? Because a lot of times, again, most like surgeons, they think, okay, I'm going to use the device a lot. And then once a year, I'll go up on podium and talk about it. That's enough. That's not enough. And so I think going down that route of just, if you really want to make this jump, spend the next 6 months just saying, I'm just going to get exposure. That's it. That's your goal. How do I get more exposure? In person, virtually, so on and so forth. And then little by little, things fall into place.
The rest of your career too.
It's totally.
You know, you go off and start your own company. You join a company. You now have a built-in audience that you're used to talking to, and they're used to hearing from you. It's just, it's again going back to, we've talked about it so many times on this podcast. Distribution. Distribute your content out there. Get it out there for people to at least see and to interact with. That's something I'm starting to do now too. Is now I'm on Twitter, a little more active on that. It's like over the weekend, posted basically a response to that article, the JAMA Internal Medicine article. I think it got 5,000 or 6,000 views. I was like, that's incredible, because I've really never posted on here. So I think getting out of your comfort zone, especially as a physician, that even if you don't think of yourself as a thought leader, you likely are. Like, you've gone through so many different things in your training, the world that you're in. You are an expert in whatever little niche that you're in. If you're super subspecialized, you probably have some information that other people are interested in, whether that's like through a formal consulting relationship or just getting it out on LinkedIn, like you're talking about, or Twitter or whatever it is. You can build up an audience of people that are going to be interested in your content, likely.
No, absolutely. And something I want to, this is investing advice, but also like startup advice, which is, a lot of times when we look at technology, let's use a perfect example. A lot of robotic companies are trying to just kill Intuitive, right? Okay. Really hard. You're not going to do it. Okay. And here's why. When I look at a new robotic company or something that's going to quote unquote compete with Intuitive, there's two things that you have to ask or you have to evaluate. Either the technology is going to be a bolt-on to an existing ecosystem, right? So if you come up with something, is it going to be something that is symbiotic and just gets introduced into the Intuitive surgical ecosystem, right? Because that is an ecosystem at that point. That's one thing. And if you're doing that in terms of an exit, and I'm making this up, but those kind of exits range anywhere from, let's say, at the very low end, $1 million, $5 million, to upwards of $400-500 million. So like a lot of companies, they're looking for bolt-on technologies, small little acquisitions that are going to be just bolt-ons to their existing business. That's the one side to look at it. The other side is to say, I'm going to develop something that is going to completely replace that ecosystem. And in that case, we're talking about something that's going to be worth billions of dollars. If it's acquired, it's going to be a transformational acquisition, like when J&J acquired Auris for $3.6 billion. In both cases, though, right, this is what it comes down to. Either A, you're building something to play in that world, right, which is perfectly fine. Or B, and this is the, these are the kind of companies I'm most interested in, they're saying, that's what you do over here. We're going to walk all the way 100 feet over here, due south, and we're building something over here. Nobody's over here yet.
That's when it comes down to, are you going to be a 10x better product than the incumbent? Because if so, then you can start to take market share potentially. But like I've talked to some surgeons that use Intuitive, and they basically have, it seems like a monopoly in terms of the actual product space.
It is.
And it's funny too, because like talking to physicians, they're like, yeah, they won't even take us out to dinner or anything, because they're like, we don't need to.
Oh, exactly. Look,
we own the entire market.
This is, there's one person I will recommend that he should come on your show. He's a close friend of mine. He's also somebody I'm very proud of. He's somebody I mentored early on. His name's Henry Peck. He's the VP of Growth and Strategy at LSI. He's the only other guy that we can spend hours talking about medtech, because we talk about it like sports. Right. So look at, I'll give you Intuitive. If you follow the money, you'll follow the truth. When you look at, let's say, Stryker, Medtronic, more than 50% of what they paid out last year was usually for like royalties, licensing, acquisitions. Intuitive, 61% of the $50 million they spent last year was to education. The top 8 of the top 10 people who received the most money from Intuitive last year were all academic centers. Why? It's propaganda. It's technological brainwashing. Yeah, exactly. That's where they want us. And it's smart. It's smart because it's like, hey, we don't need to spend money on. And by the way, Intuitive, just, you know, like that's for, you got to really stand in awe of what Intuitive has done, because Intuitive, they're sitting on, I'm pretty sure, their own IP and tech that they've acquired over the years, that they're, it's just like break glass just in case. It's like this technology comes out. Hey, you know what? Break this glass. We're going to start selling these things for free. Like they, I'm positive they're sitting on a bunch of stuff.
It's a Microsoft model.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much, man. Pretty much. But yeah, again, these are the kind of things that as you get exposure to it, like listening to podcasts like this, reading blogs, just reading and asking questions, and you start to piece things together, and then you're able to develop something that most people haven't thought of developing. I'll give you another really interesting example. I had the president of Stryker come on my show, and we talked about the tough years that Stryker went through, like around 08 when the economy crashed and everything, and then they blew up billions and billions of dollars in revenue. And I asked him, I was like, what was the big strategic technology that did this? Was it the acquisition of the Mako robot? It's just, he said, no, he was like, it was waste management. That was what made Stryker a lot of money in the from 2010 to 16. That was the thing that like saved Stryker. Like it was a huge deal. It was waste management. Who would have thought of that?
You have to explain that. What do you mean by waste management? And how did that
Yeah, happen? So they had some.
And also we'll link to this episode.
They had some technology that had to do with like sterile processing, waste management. I don't even know what the hell it was. But that was the thing that like brought in a lot of revenue. It was like a very attractive thing for hospitals to adopt. And essentially, I believe that was a big lever for Stryker to pull for other technology and stuff.
That's interesting. So you basically, know? I'm assuming what they did was they brought whatever that is out. It made a crap ton of revenue and they just reinvested it in other products.
I'll have to
go back and listen to that episode.
Here's another great example. I don't know what it's at now, but like when I last looked at it, was 2019, 2020, 1/3 of Intuitive's revenue. So it was almost like $1 billion. 1/3 of it is from service contracts, right? So like when you buy a robot, you pay for insurance, but then there's servicing that's needed. The robot needs to be upgraded. It needs to be fixed and everything. 1/3 of their revenue came from that. So
that's super interesting.
Yeah. So like there's all kinds of things like little levers you learn how to pull. Look, for example, I'll use my business as an example. The lion's share of my course revenue, right, comes from people actually purchasing my course, which is a $3,000 course. I think at this, the segment that's growing, it's like maybe 1/4 of my revenue for my course side is this little recurring $20 a month subscription to have access to my calls and everything. That's growing to the point where I'm like, man, maybe I should start investing more on a really low cost recurring model. So these are the kind of things that like, I'll tell you, like in it being aggressively curious about things, right? The quality of your life, the quality of your career will be reflected in the quality of questions you ask yourself. Same thing with being a founder, same thing with being a startup investor. I don't know. I say this, I should
you
probably
get a lot of alpha from the questions that you ask companies.
Oh, absolutely.
That's a very fair point.
Oh, absolutely.
Ask the right questions and get to the heart of, hey, am I going to invest or not? Is this the right company to invest in? Or the quality of your questions and the quality of their answers tells you a lot about whether or not you're going to grow.
Yeah. And again, like, there ain't no money in easy things. Like a lot of these VCs, I'm going to say another thing that's going to piss a lot of VCs off, but a lot of these VCs, this is usually a conversation. Hey, Mr. and Miss VC, nice to meet you. I have a lot of deal flow. What kind of deals are you looking for? It's like, how, this is a really cool startup. No, not that. It's like, what are you looking for? So, Mark, we're really looking for growth stage companies. So a company that's doing at least 5 or 10 or 15 mil in annual recurring revenue every year. I'm like, great. Like a chimp can invest in that. Doesn't take a genius to say, oh, this company's making money. Hey, let's give them more money and they'll make like that. That's not, in my opinion, very difficult to do.
It's not the adventurous piece of venture capital. Like it used to be, it was adventure capital. It wasn't venture
exactly.
capital.
Exactly. Like, there's not a lot. Not the adventurous piece. And this is the problem in medtech. But again, you have to play the game. So I know we're well over time here, but I'll give my opinion, $1 million advice. And this is something that I did at Petrero with our CEO, Joe Urban. When we were raising a $15 million Series C, the middle of the pandemic, and we ended a distribution contract with a huge medtech company. So we had no distribution, nothing. We were like, We had no pipeline. This is where I implemented that the approach using social, and we filled our pipeline. If you cannot show revenue, show a full pipeline. Have a pipeline where it's meeting set, meeting complete, value analysis committee, whatever. Just if you show a pipeline to an investor with a bunch of cards with hospital names on it, say, here's what we have, that's the next best thing other than revenue. Don't show nothing. Show letters of intent. The two things that companies fail, that cause a company to fail, number one is like they need more capital, which just, it's a simple solution. Give them more capital. And the second thing, which is the hardest one, is interest. Most VCs are doing their due diligence to say, is there interest in this? So actually show it.
For me as an investor, completely agree. I love revenue though. That is.
Yeah,
that
who
is
doesn't, man?
Way that, hey, somebody's willing to pay for a solution. Even if it's a small amount of revenue, but you have some people.
I agree.
Your service or your thing is. If you can sell it to a few people that are not your friends, there's, okay, you have something to start with.
Yeah.
You're not on second or third base, but you at least are getting towards first base of saying, there's somebody out there that is not my best friend that's willing to pay me.
Absolutely. And again, like you bring up really good points here. Most physicians, not physicians even, most startup founders are like, man, if we just get this into Hopkins or UCSF, we're money. Yes, the problem with those places is that it takes a long time. And even if you can get it in right away, they're going to try and be like, hey, we're not stupid. We know the value of our brand. We want this for free. My personal opinion,
for sure.
I don't know, Greg, how you feel about this. You're better off getting, I don't know, a few ASCs.
A community hospital.
Yeah, to be paying money than just to be like, we got Hopkins using it. They're using it for free.
That's always the question. They're like, yeah, we have Hopkins, UCSF, University of Washington. It's great. How much revenue are you making? They're like, we're not.
We're doing studies with them. Great. Let us know when that study is done.
You're like, you don't. So you have a pilot. Great. Did anybody convert to a paying customer from the pilot? No, not yet. We're still like, it's okay. I get why you're saying it in this certain way, but eventually an investor is just going to get down to the actual points of, do you have revenue coming in? Where are you at in your pipeline, like you're talking about? It's like, you got to at least be upfront.
This is the part that like drives me nuts about software companies is that like every time they raise a bunch of money, they act like they celebrate it. Like, we raised $100 million. Yeah, I'm like, who cares?
That's the goal.
Who cares? Who cares? And there's so many of these companies that are like, I don't know who needs to hear this. Most companies aren't Amazon. Amazon was like losing money year over year, but because they're
unprofitable.
They're betting on the future. But most companies are not that. And these SaaS companies, I'm like, man, I was like, hey, anybody around here, you guys know how to make some money? I've told like a lot of SaaS people like get pissed when I say, like, you guys know how to make some money? You guys making money around here?
There was a Twitter post that was about this exact topic. And it was like, basically, raise your hand if you've made more annual revenue than money that you've raised. And there was like maybe five people.
Those
are the founders that are going to have nice exits for themselves.
I'll tell you, like, I'll have to send this to you. But I created so again, I love frameworks and stuff. So Gartner's Hype Cycle for Emerging Technologies is one of the frameworks that I use for what I do. But I created this hype cycle called the VC Hype Cycle of Emerging Technologies. And so this is in the last, from 2022 to 2024, at least in my estimation, starts off with the innovation trigger of the metaverse. Then it spikes at crypto and Web3. Then it's starting to go down now. The hype cycle is starting to go down with generative AI. So that's where we're at. So I know what's next. But like, we went through that entire thing. Like, you remember, like, nobody talks about the metaverse anymore. What the hell happened to that thing?
No, definitely not. Yeah. Web3, crypto, metaverse. I remember seeing some people with like the metaverse annual meetings during COVID, like people going through exhibit halls like with their Oculus on.
Oh my God. I'm like, 2020 was such a funny year, man. Wow. There's just like that, like in terms of being, if you're like a connoisseur, a museum curator of memes, like 2020, man. There's some good vintage in that year.
It's been some wild times, yeah. All right, well, I think we'll end there. We would love to have you back on. This was interesting, in-depth conversation. I loved it. I guess any last-minute things that you want to plug yourself, anything that's coming up for you and your company, podcast, anything?
Yeah, look, like, go follow the State of MedTech. I mean, at the very least, while you're listening, I add a CME credit to almost all the episodes, especially the ones that are going to be specific to physicians, so you can get a free CME credit by listening to my stuff. Give it 5 stars and a review. And then just follow me on LinkedIn. Right now, if somebody's so eager that they can't hold themselves, you can go to upgrademylinkedin.com. And that's like my little mini course on how to upgrade your LinkedIn profile for a sales standpoint, marketing. So you'll learn a lot from there. I'm in the middle of making one specifically for physicians. So if you just follow me on LinkedIn, I will be announcing it soon. But yeah, that's it. And then if you're a listener of this show, of Greg's show, you better have given it 5 stars and written a review. If you haven't, stop what you're doing and give it 5 stars, write a review for it. It's very important.
That is helpful for the algorithms out there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's what it's all about.
All right. We'll drop a lot of information into the show notes with hyperlinks to everything too, for his LinkedIn profile, the podcast, et cetera. Omar, thanks for coming on. And again, hopefully we can have you on in the future. This is a fun one.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Greg.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. As always, we'd like to remind you that the information and opinions expressed on this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only and should not be construed as financial or investment advice. Before making any investment decisions, we strongly recommend that you consult with your lawyer, tax professional, and financial planner. Keep in mind that investing in startups can be extremely risky, and there's a potential for loss of your entire investment. Remember to always conduct thorough research and consider your risk tolerance before making any financial decisions. Stay informed, and we look forward to having you join us on our next episode of the Physician Syndicate Podcast.